Welcome in. Thank you so much for joining us on the CCA California podcast. Good to be with you another week. I am your host, Chris Arechidera, CCA California. This week, we've got, special co-host, friend of the podcast, Mr. Jim Hendricks. Jim, how are you, man?
Yeah, I am doing great. It's great to be here with you and talking a little bit fishing.
Yeah, a little bit fishing. And it's been a while. I think it's been maybe 6 months, maybe a year or so.
Yeah, at least. Last time I didn't get to come in studio. So this one is a lot of fun. Get to see the new studio and the offices. It's a pretty cool setup.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. Well, I think the last time we had you on was specifically talking about 30 by 30. And this week, we actually have a very special guest. We've got Mike Escrow from the Ocean Protection Council, part of CNRA. Mike, welcome to the podcast, man. How are you?
Hey, thanks, Chris. Thanks, Jim. I'm doing really well. Thanks so much for having me.
Awesome. Awesome, man. Well, I'll start you off easy here. I know we're going to get into so many different topics with 30 by 30 and all that stuff, but how's 2024 been for you so far?
So far, so good, man. Yeah. It's been off to a busy start. Feel like we came out of the gate running in 2024, but it's all exciting stuff. So yeah, things are going well. Hope going well for you guys too.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, I've asked Jim to join us in our conversation. I know with, like I said, we're going to get on to 30 by 30, but before we do that, tell us a little bit about yourself, what your background is and what you do at OPC.
Yeah. So I my background is in marine science, marine ecology. I actually was a scuba instructor, kind of fell in love with the ocean that way long before I got into marine science and policy, but my scientific training is really, near shore kelp forest and deep water marine ecology, a little bit on MPA effectiveness and management. And after grad school, I bounced around for a little while and ultimately ended up at the Ocean Protection Council, which I think is it's a really cool place to work because, for those of you guys listening who haven't heard of OPC, we essentially serve as the governor's advisor on coastal and ocean policy. Which means we work really closely with the managing agencies. We work really closely with the department on all things MPAs and fisheries, work really closely with the California Fish and Game Commission and other agencies. But we get to kind of have one foot in the science, which I'm always, really excited about. But then that other foot in how the science and the policy touches down and actually makes a difference for communities in California, right? So it's a good, I like science, but I especially really like communicating science and making science something that, matters to people. So I have the privilege at OPC of leading our, what we call kind of the biodiversity side of the house. So that's marine ecosystems, MPA management, fisheries and aquaculture, restoration. We do a lot of work on kelp restoration, for example. And I also lead up our engagement with California Native American tribes as well.
Wow, that's a mouthful to say the least.
Absolutely.
It's all good stuff.
You're a busy guy.
Try to
stay busy. So, Michael, this is Jim. If you could, anglers have heard a lot about 30 by 30. They've heard a lot from us and they've heard a lot from, the state government about what 30 by 30 is and what it's supposed to do and function, when it will be effective. Why don't you give our listeners here a rundown on what 30 by 30 really is and what it means to anglers?
Yeah, so I think anglers have heard a lot about 30 by 30 kind of at a high level, and the state's put out a lot kind of explaining our broad intent to conserve biodiversity. But I think a lot of folks just kind of want to know, hey, where and when can I go fishing, right? I mean, and what threats are you actually trying to address? So I'm going to try to keep our conversation today kind of as grounded in what 30 by 30 really means and sort of avoid the kind of high level policy language. Essentially, this is 30 by 30 has been a global movement for some time. Actually, the United Nations adopted it as a global target at the UN Biodiversity Conference in Montreal in 2022. So it is now this global target that the world is shooting for. But what we're trying to figure out in California, after the governor adopted the target, several years ago now in 2020 through executive order and was subsequently institutionalized codified as part of Senate Bill 337 last year. So what does that actually mean to conserve 30% of our lands and waters by 2030? So I think first and most importantly is that word conserve. You know, we want to take a conservation-based approach. And actually, I think, you know, OPC and the angling community don't really differ too much here, that conservation of biodiversity is something we all want, right? It's just a question about how do we get there and what threats are we actually addressing? So, you know, we've got this definition of conservation that's pretty broad. It's areas that are, you know, that are durably protected and managed to sustain biodiversity, so have good outcomes for biodiversity. And what we are trying to do now is parse that out into, okay, well, what counts for 30 by 30 and what doesn't? You know, at the time that initial document, Pathways to 30 by 30, which I think many in your audience might have heard about, was published, we made the call that, hey, you know, right now we feel like our MPA network, which covers 16% of state waters, meets that definition, right? Those MPAs are durably protected. And also, you know, we don't have all the answers about MPA effectiveness, and we can get into some of the results from the recent 10-year review of the MPAs later if you want. But, you know, generally we have seen in many areas and many places some positive outcomes for biodiversity from the MPAs. And I know MPAs aren't necessarily popular with anglers, but we do have some good science showing, hey, these are, you know, in many areas, these places are working as designed. But that being said, you know, MPAs aren't the only way to achieve ocean conservation, because fishing isn't the only quote unquote threat. I would argue that it isn't a threat in all circumstances and situations.
Well, glad to hear you say that. Yay.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's something Wayne and I talked about early on, that, you know, fishermen aren't the enemy here. Right. I mean, you guys are the Coastal Conservation Association. I think we believe in a lot of the same stuff. So no, you know, fishing has an impact on marine ecosystems for sure, but there's different types, there's different levels. And in many areas, you know, issues like water quality, you know, pollution, the loss of our kelp forests, those are having bigger impacts than fishing. Not everywhere, but in many places. Right. So, you know, I think the question before us now is, okay, well, apart from MPAs, which will continue to have this network that's adaptively managed, and again, we can get into what all that means, but there are ways to achieve conservation beyond just MPAs. So we're interested in partnering with our federal partners to strengthen protections in national marine sanctuaries. Those could be water quality protections, plastic pollution, again, kelp restoration, see what else we can do in those sanctuary boundaries. We're interested in looking at all these other areas in California state waters that are spatially managed in some way. So areas that are, you know, essential fish habitat or estuary research reserves. There are all these little boxes on the map that have different regulations that, you know, that likely do contribute to biodiversity conservation in some way. So we're initiating this scientific assessment of what the benefits of those areas are. And then also trying to strengthen partnerships with tribes as well, and really strengthen partnerships with all communities in California, so that ultimately, you know, we get from that 16% that counts currently to that 30%, but we're not going to do it by doubling the size of the MPA network. We're going to be a little more, we're going to zoom out a little bit and take a more holistic view of conservation, and work to get there through these four kind of integrated pathways. So hopefully that makes a little more sense about how 30 by 30 actually, you know, touches down in California.
It certainly does. And thank you for that explanation. That's a broad overview, as you indicate, kind of a 30,000 foot view of what's going on. You mentioned that there's a scientific assessment underway right now. Can you tell our listeners, what does that mean? You know, and where, you know, at what stage are we now with the scientific assessment?
Yeah, so OPC just convened this science working group. We're calling it an advisory panel of folks that work, scientists that work in ecology, in fisheries, in social science. And essentially what they've asked them to do is, okay, can you take that broad definition of conservation that I mentioned earlier, that definition that's in the Pathways to 30 by 30 document, you know, basically that part about providing benefits for biodiversity, and break that down into some objective criteria. So essentially, what's the flow chart, right? Or what are the objective check boxes that an area would need to meet that definition? They've just started their work, and really what they're doing right now is sort of, we had our first meeting last week. It was really productive. They're, you know, starting to like catalog, organize all of those different threats that are out there, threats to biodiversity, and then what these different, you know, regulations we have in California are and how the regulations address some of those threats. So we're going to be pulling together those criteria, but then we're going to put them out for public comment. And what we're hoping to do is go up and down the state this year, you know, and get out to fishing communities, to coastal communities, to ports, to harbors, and, you know, put those criteria out there and say, hey, this is what our science team came up with, but now we want to ground truth it with the folks who are actually out there in and on the water. What did we miss? What did we get right? What did we get wrong? And maybe, you know, throw some maps up there and start to look at what areas might count and what wouldn't according to these criteria. I know, you know, maybe many of your listeners went through the MLPA process. I didn't. I was in grad school at the time. I you know, came to MPA management later, but I understand there's, you know, deep history and some deep wounds with that process, and nobody wants to do MLPA 2.0. That's not what we're talking about. But we're talking about public workshops to really help understand, okay, you know, here's what we're starting to shape. And does that make sense to, you know, to you? So that's okay. That's the big goal for this year.
Okay. Well, thanks. I appreciate you mentioning the MLPA implementation. I was around at that particular time, and I'm going to tell you that most anglers felt like we got railroaded on that one. And I think that's part of the kind of, concern that all our anglers have now is that maybe even though we say there's not going to be any more MPAs or expansion of MPAs within the 30 by 30 process, and anglers that I've talked to feel like, I think we're being slow played on this one. What kind of reassurances can you give to people listening now who say, oh, this is just going to be another, you know, MLPA 2.0, as you put it?
Yeah, well, you know, I understand there's maybe not a lot of trust. That's something that I, you know, personal goal of mine, just, you know, showing up on podcasts like this or coming out to events where we're hoping to be at some of the fishing shows this year to just have some conversations and build some relationships and trust, because that's really, you know, it's almost one conversation at a time that it takes to build trust. The other thing that's important is to be really, you know, we have to be very transparent and honest about where we are. So, for example, I mentioned MPA adaptive management. You know, the Fish and Game Commission right now, not right now, but soon, will be considering petitions. I know some angling communities have submitted petitions. I know some NGO communities have submitted petitions for changes to the MPA network. And I want to be really transparent that changes to the MPA network are on the table, but they would need to be scientifically justified. So that could include reg changes, boundary changes, expansions, getting rid of some, adding new one, all those things theoretically could be considered by the Fish and Game Commission, but it would have to be scientifically justified and also have a high degree of community support. So I would encourage folks from the angling community to get involved. You know, CCA Cal has been great, I think, about organizing folks to be a voice in that process. So, you know, I can't say that those MPA boundaries and regulations wouldn't change through this process that the commission and the department are leading, but I think it would be appropriate to think of them as, if they were to happen, as tweaks to the network and not, hey, all of a sudden we're going to expand this from 16% to 30%.
Right, right. And I think it's important that we point out that the 30 by 30 process is separate from the MLPA decadal review, management review process. Even though they do work hand in hand in terms of conservation, they are two different processes. So when we look at 30 by 30, it specifically says in the document there is no process to expand or create new MPAs to achieve 30 by 30 goals. But
exactly.
On the other hand, there is the MLPA decadal review that is occurring right now that everything is on the table, as you mentioned. And we're going to have a lot of groups pushing for expansion of MPAs. And we're going to have a lot of groups pushing for contraction of MPAs. Right. So I don't know where we will land in that process, but I kind of want to talk about 30 by 30 right now. And then we can move on to the MPA decadal review, mm-hmm. talk about how that might work going forward. So I just don't want listeners to say, oh, the MPAs and 30 by 30 are the same. They're not, they're two different processes.
Right. That is a really important point. So thank you for clarifying that.
So tell me, as this advisory panel looks at 30 by 30, what are some of the kinds of threats? You don't have to, list them all, but I'm just curious, what are some of the threats that they are looking at and considering and prioritizing?
Yeah, I mean, this discussion last week was so interesting because it was cool to kind of, get all those threats out there on the table and start thinking about them more holistically, So some of the threats we're thinking about, water quality, that's a huge one. So whether that be point source pollution or harmful algal blooms, is fish safe to eat? Are people safe to go swimming in the ocean, surfing or diving or whatever? I mean, that's huge. And water quality is a threat, a major threat to biodiversity at many places along the California coast. So that's a big one. I would include in that plastic pollution. Mm-hmm. That's a hard one to mitigate kind of within some kind of box on a map. But we're very concerned about plastic pollution. That's both big plastics and microplastics. We're concerned about threats to whales. So entanglement, of course, is always a big one, but also vessel ship strikes. So whales that are, spending more mm-hmm. time close to shore and getting hit by these big vessels that are moving fast through state waters. Let's see, what else have we talked about? Dredging and dumping, big ones. So there's kind of like the threats that are driven by humans, right? But then there's also, bigger threats kind of more driven by nature. I mean, climate change, right? So climate change affects everything from ocean acidification, less dissolved oxygen, deeper in the water. I mentioned really near and dear to my heart because, like I said, I was diving in the kelp forests in Monterey before I was ever doing this policy work. Kelp declines, the urchin barrens that have happened on the North Coast, and now we're seeing urchin barrens pop up on the Monterey Peninsula too. So all of those climate driven threats are top of mind for us as well. So I'd kind of bin them into those those human impacts, but then also the broader climate impacts.
So thank you. That helps clarify things. What I am wondering is how 30 by 30, what are some of the remediation steps that could conceivably be considered in terms of improving water quality or reducing plastic pollution or mitigating climate change for that matter?
Yeah, well, climate change that's a hard one. But so maybe we'll start with that one first. So, something you might consider for 30 by 30 is like an area that's a kelp restoration area, right? So if there's some area where there's active restoration taking place to improve the biodiversity of that area, and one of the ways we're thinking about 30 by 30 is also how all these protections layer on top of each other and add up to something that's maybe greater than the sum of its parts. So you might have an area where they're called areas of special biological significance. It's a special designation that protects water quality by limiting or I think entirely reducing what can be discharged into the ocean from shore. So if you've got that water quality protection area right there and you're doing kelp restoration, like now you've got two really meaningful protections for biodiversity in a single area, right? Mm-hmm. Similarly, the Greater Farallones National Marine Sanctuary right now off the North Central Coast of San Francisco Bay, they're updating their management plan. And so through a public process, right? And so we've been kind of since the beginning, the scoping of that, you know, they're still pretty early on, but like even since the scoping days of what was going to be in this new management plan, we've been talking to the sanctuary about, okay, well, what additional work could you do, you know, to reduce the speeds of vessels that are going through sanctuary waters to reduce threats to whales, for example, or to encourage that more active eelgrass restoration or kelp restoration is happening. We're kind of, you know, limited in a way to those designations, to working within the boundaries of the designations that already exist. Yeah, I mean, I think those, you know, additional or strengthened protections for what, you know, that pollution that might get discharged into the ocean from land, encouraging restoration, thinking about threats to marine mammals. These are all things that are on the table. And you know, it's not just me, right? It's not just me coming up with these. It's not just OPC coming up with these. That's something that we're asking our scientific advisory panel to dig into. You know, once you think about all the threats, what could be implemented to address those threats? And that's something that we're going to want public input on as well.
Sure, sure. I think that one of the concerns that anglers might have in terms of remediation would be speed reductions. I know on the East Coast right now, on the federal level, they're going through this process right now, and they're asking even small boats, you know, as small as 35 feet in length, to reduce speeds down to like 10 miles an hour max.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. And so there's a big battle brewing on the East Coast about, you know, is that really a necessary step? I mean, I know a very, very few, I could count on one hand, maybe, whale strikes by small boats. And usually it's the small boat that really takes the hit on that one.
I feel bad for the small boat.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not trying to make light of that. And I'm sure it hurts the marine mammal. I'm sure it hurts a blue whale when it gets hit. But when we talk about speed reductions, are we primarily talking about commercial shipping?
Yeah, this is actually the first I've heard about speed reductions being applied to smaller boats like that. All of our conversations have been about the big, you know, the big shipping, like container ships, right?
Right, right. Freighters, tankers, things like that. Exactly. Okay, that's good to hear. That's good to hear. One of the pressing questions we have, because we've been, you know, how long have we been involved in the 30 by 30 process? How many years has this been going on?
So this has been, we are coming up on, well, it'll be 4 this year. So 2020, the executive order was signed, and then there were 2 years spent with really extensive public comment process to develop the pathways to 30 by 30 document. And now we're approaching 2 years out from the publication of that document.
Okay. So, and one of the big questions, you mentioned that we've got the 16%. Number of MPAs, which are considered durably conserved, or is it preserved?
That's the term? That's an important. I think that's actually an important distinction. So conserved, right? I think conservation to me implies a model where, you know, where humans are involved versus preservation. I think is, you know, I think of setting an area aside and saying this is a no-go zone, and that's really not a model of conservation that we. You know, that we're in support of as the state. I mean, we really want to think about ways that people and nature can exist and thrive together, not separated. So I would say conservation, not preservation.
So thank you. The big question right now, it's kind of been ongoing for a year or two here, is that the three national marine sanctuaries along the California coast, they're not currently included in the 30 by 30 areas, or at least at the time we met last year, that the National Marine Sanctuaries didn't meet the definition of durably conserved or durably protected, I guess is a better, I guess the way that it's phrased in the document.
Yeah.
Since then that's changed. I sat in on a workshop and leader of the manager of the National Marine Sanctuary described them as durably protected. And when I asked Director Eckerly about this, she said, yes, they are. They are durably protected. So I guess the next step is, what level of ecosystem benefits these the National Marine Sanctuaries provide. That is that the next step to decide in deciding whether or not they should be considered part of 30 by 30?
That's exactly right. Yeah. So sanctuary, that definition of a 30 by 30 conserved area or an area that counts, it's got two parts, right? So it's got the durable protection, but then it's got the biodiversity benefits. And so I think, you know, the state determined at the time that Pathways was published that yes, these areas are durably protected, but it's not that they don't have biodiversity benefits. We just don't have a good, you know, for MPAs, we've got this really comprehensive monitoring program that's shown results. With sanctuaries, the level of monitoring and understanding of what their regulations are doing for biodiversity is a little more mixed, right? And sanctuaries do a lot. Like, don't get me wrong, sanctuaries do a lot to protect biodiversity, but, you know, I think through that conversation, we realized we need some more objective criteria here so that we can go to sanctuary managers and say, okay, to us, biodiversity benefits includes water quality protection. It includes, you know, maybe these particular types of like industrial fishing aren't allowed, whatever. I'm speaking hypothetically here, but sure, whatever those criteria might be, that can help us work with the sanctuary managers and say, okay, well, here are the additional things we could do. And it might differ sanctuary by sanctuary, right? So it might be that, you know, there's threats in Greater Farallones that might not be applicable down in Channel Islands. And I'll also mention that we've got, you know, this proposal for the new Chumash Heritage Marine Sanctuary off the Central Coast, right? That's a golden opportunity for the state to say, hey, here are the types of things the types of protections we would want to see in this new sanctuary, based on the criteria that, again, our science panel's helping us develop and that we're going to be putting out for public review and discussion and comment later this year.
So when we talk about the tribal sanctuaries, those will fall under tribal stewardship, correct?
Well, if they are, so the Chumash Heritage, because it would be an actual National Marine Sanctuary, that would fall kind of more under the sanctuary bucket. But we have another bucket focused on tribal areas, and these are areas that it's kind of a new concept. But we heard from many tribes when we were doing some of that initial 30 by 30 outreach, you know, before Pathways was even published, that they wanted to establish their own areas. And so we don't really have a good, you know, we have the concept, but we don't really have a good process for what that might actually look like in terms of drawing a box on a map and setting regulations. But the idea would be that, you know, the state and the tribes would enter into some kind of agreement where the tribes would be stewarding their, you know, ancestral waters in some way in accordance with their traditional practices, right? And that has the potential to count for 30 by 30. So they're kind of two separate buckets.
Yeah. Maybe a third process then, in addition to 30 by 30 in the MPA decadal review, huh?
Yeah, I think that's actually a good way to think about it. I mean, you can kind of think of like these four processes running in parallel. So we've got the MPA decadal review. We've got this consultation with tribes that we're just starting about tribal stewardship or indigenous stewardship areas. Then we've got the sanctuary discussion, which is unfolding with sanctuary managers. And then we've got this fourth process about all the other spatial management measures in state waters and which of those might count for 30 by 30. So it's really kind of four trains on four parallel tracks, but they're all helping us get to the 30%.
So I'm going to speak to angler concerns in the as we're looking at the National Marine Sanctuaries and whether or not they'll count towards 30 by 30 or not. One of the concerns is perhaps one of the protections that will be added to the marine sanctuaries is that there'll be restrictions on recreational angling within those sanctuaries. Now, I know that's not within the purview of the state. They are federally managed areas. But is that a possibility that we could lose fishing access to more of the National Marine Sanctuary waters?
Well, I don't want to speak for our federal partners, but I will say that sanctuaries don't manage fishing, right? And I don't want to speak for the feds, but I don't think there's much of an appetite, especially as it relates to recreational fishing. I do think that, you know, there are conversations we can have about, you know, some of our NGO friends have been talking to us about gill netting that's happening in certain portions of Channel Islands. And, you know, that's something that might be worth taking a closer look at, right? Based on the impacts that we know that particular type of fishing can have. In my conversations with sanctuary folks to date, you know, recreational angling has not come up as a threat to biodiversity that's at the same level as, you know, like kelp loss, like I've talked about, water quality, vessel ship strikes. So I couldn't honestly say it's impossible, but I just don't see much of an appetite for it at the current moment. And I don't see scientific data really that's saying that's something that, you know, it'd be worth pursuing.
Mike, with, you know, with so many different, you know, after listening to you speak the last couple of minutes, it seems like there's so many different opportunities to where, you know, this 30 by 30 deal, you know, we've already locked and loaded 16% with MPAs and all that. That's set and done pretty much. When it comes to all these national marine sanctuaries, all these different, I'll call them opportunities that, you know, are already durably conserved and all that, you know, in your mind, are we already there at 30%? And if so, I mean, what is it, just a matter of just trying to figure out which areas are going to count and which ones aren't?
I don't think we're there. I feel really good about the 16% because, like I said, I do feel that MPAs, you know, provide that it's hard to assess MPAs individually, but the entire network, I do believe, provides strong biodiversity benefits for California. I need a little bit more information about some of these other areas and what type of biodiversity benefits they provide. But do I think, in terms of the spirit of that definition, you know, managed for really good biodiversity outcomes, I don't think we're at 30% yet. But I do think that this movement can help to drive action in terms of identifying what those threats are and thinking about how we mitigate those threats. So if we look at the current landscape of water quality protection, for example, and say, hey, you know, we've only got, I wish my colleagues, Abby and Anne, were on this podcast with us. So Abby leads up all of our kind of geographical data and Anne leads a lot of our community engagement. And they've just been fantastic members of our team. And Abby would know this number right off the top of her head, but I don't. So some portion of state waters that are covered by water quality protection, well, if we need to bump that up, you know, I'm all for that. I think that we always, you know, we can always go farther to protect biodiversity. And I think 30 by 30 is going to help us get there. But no, I don't think we're going to do kind of this, you know, desk analysis and public comment period and realize like, oh, well, look, we're already at 45. Like, I think we've still got a little ways to go.
So if we... If the National Marine Sanctuaries were ultimately deemed to be durably protected, though, wouldn't we, and those were added to 16%, the 16% of the coast that's protected by an MPA, wouldn't that bring us very, very close to the 30% mark?
Yeah, that would. So the sanctuaries altogether, their footprint is about 40% of state waters, right? And just, even if you remove the MPAs that are in sanctuaries so they don't get double counted, yes, if all the sanctuaries were to count, then we'd be, I don't know, again, the exact number, but we would be well over 30. But I think that each sanctuary is different, right? In terms of exactly what kind of, I mean, they all have some regulations in common, but in terms of exactly what the specific regulations are, you know, Channel Islands is different from Farallones, which will be slightly different from Chumash. And so I think we got to assess on a case by case basis. And it could end up that, you know, some sanctuaries have special zones within them. So areas where seabirds are protected or areas where you can't fly drones because that disturbs seals.
Right.
What have you. And so maybe it'll be some of those smaller areas that count initially. And then, you know, gradually we work with sanctuaries to get more and more of the sanctuary to count. And, you know, I got to say, obviously, we got to put points on the board to get to that 30%. That's our mandate. You know, it's part of my job. But I'm honestly more interested in and not just the number, but what are we actually doing for biodiversity, right? What are we actually doing that's meaningful? And I think that approach of kind of starting with like, okay, what are these areas within sanctuaries where kelp is being restored, and how can we like broaden that out so more of the sanctuary is, you know, quote unquote protected or conserved in this way, will be is more important to me than just getting to 30.
Okay. So when you say put points on the board, you're really talking about adding additional protections.
Or classifying areas that already exist as conserved, right? Because right now there's this whole bucket of areas where we're basically saying we don't have enough objective information yet to make a determination, right?
So when you know, you had mentioned about pollutions and plastics and microplastics earlier, about how, you know, I think those are common goal or common ground for all of us to get behind, trying to eliminate all that in our oceans and keep everything clean and everything. You know, it really doesn't have too much to do with recreational fishing and all that. What would be some of your solutions to where, you know, maybe not going, you know, obviously trying to mitigate those, but, you know, what would be some solutions or potential solutions to get rid of all that?
In terms of pollution, I mean, man, it's hard. I think it's a lot harder to clean up the ocean than it is to reduce what's actively being, you know, discharged into the ocean. So I think, you know, people talk about the term source reduction, right? So reducing that pollution, whether it be plastic or any other pollutant at the source. I think, you know, we gotta work at that land sea boundary to make sure that activities that are happening on land, you know, don't end up negatively impacting the ocean. So I'd like to see us working a little bit closer, you know, with our partners at like water boards, for example. There we have an entire water quality program at OPC that, you know, has worked with plastic producers, for example, to really reduce that plastic at the source, because man, the science just shows that it is hard, if not downright impossible, to get out there and clean it up. That's when it comes to plastics. Obviously, if it's something like, you know, oil spills or something like that, then of course, you know, you do need to go out there and there's these massive cleanup efforts. But yeah, I think for plastics and for some of these new kind of emerging contaminants that we're talking about, it's about source reduction.
Yeah, water quality is something everybody can get behind. In fact, I'm on the marketing, I chair the marketing committee for CCA California. And our one big credo is let's fix the big problems. Let's fix urban runoff, agricultural runoff, sewage spills, plastic pollution.
Mylar balloons.
We have programs that do that. Let's start focusing on the big problems and stop blaming anglers for the health of the ocean, the poor health of the ocean. That's kind of our credo. So when you're talking improving water quality, we're all in agreement. We can join hands and say that's a goal, very worthy goal, and we need to pursue it.
I think there's a lot of common ground. You know, I really do. I think that we want to look at threats from a broad perspective. You know, yeah, we recognize fishing has an impact on the ocean. There's no way to say that it doesn't. But we also recognize that, you know, folks who are out there spearfishing or folks that are taking their kids out, you know, for a day on the water, that's really different from commercial fishing. And when you talk about commercial fishing, you know, those of us who like to eat seafood and like to eat, you know, California, you know, seafood from California that's sustainably harvested. Well, there's guys out there that are risking their lives to bring us that food, right?
And so, right. The lobster fishery is a great example of that.
100%. Yeah, 100%. So we're trying to walk that fine line between, hey, we got to recognize that human activity in the ocean, especially human activity that has taken life out of the ocean, like that's going to have an impact. But what is the impact relative to our broader goal of conserving biodiversity? You know, we just fundamentally don't think that some level of fishing is incompatible with biodiversity, and that in many ways that you know, fishing, it's bringing people closer to the ocean, it's strengthening those connections, it's inspiring another generation of ocean stewards. That in many ways, you know, fishermen can be some of the most ardent conservationists I've met have been have been fishermen. So yeah, fishermen aren't the enemy. Anglers aren't the enemy. But we do all need to work together and find, you know, find solutions that, that work for everybody.
Yeah. Yeah. You're right. I would take that step further and say anglers are, you know, putting back, into the ocean. The white sea bass fishery, hatchery is a great example of that. It's supported almost totally by, license, the enhancement stamp on the California state license, fishing license. So we're putting back, we've got research projects going on for rockfish. We go, anglers go out there and help the state research the rockfish populations. So I think anglers are putting back into the ocean as well as catching fish.
And to put even further, you know, the younger generation coming up, the kids that are fishing the bays and the shore pounders and all that, they're already coming into the game, the fishing game, conservation minded, because they're all letting their saltwater bass go.
Yeah.
I mean, consistently.
Yeah. So they've really developed a catch and release ethic that is, I believe me, when I was young, I did not have that ethic. I do today, but the kids nowadays it's from the freshwater bass tournament scene. It's all catch and release. They take a picture and they put the fish back into the ocean. So I want to ask one question about when the advisory panel report when we can expect this to be available for review and public comment.
Yeah. So we're looking at putting that out for public comment in June. So our plan is to, you know, we have these quarterly Ocean Protection Council meetings. We'll have a presentation at our June council meeting, and that will officially kick off this longer, you know, multi-month public outreach campaign.
So Mike, to take it a step further, obviously the goal is, you know, it's got to be achieved by 2030, which is, you know, 6 years away. But as far as the timeline goes and everything, where do you see this going over the next 6 years and how we get there?
Yeah. So I think, well, let's start small and focus on this year and then kind of zoom out. So I think, you know, ideally by the end of this year, we will have this you know, robust set of criteria that's been developed by scientists, that's, you know, been vetted by the public. There's been this public comment process. There's been a tribal consultation process. And, you know, we end up with a set of criteria that, you know, maybe not everybody's going to be thrilled with, but that works generally and makes sense to most people, right? And that has gone through that very transparent process. And I think, you know, that we're hoping will be the case by late fall. So that then, you know, closer towards the end of this year, beginning of next year, we'll be able to sit down and say, okay, now let's apply these criteria to this, you know, big patchwork of spatial management measures that are in California state waters and look at what might count beyond MPAs and sanctuaries, right? So some of those water quality protected areas, some of those, you know, fisheries management closures, maybe military restricted areas. Is there anything that already meets our definition? And then use also that criteria to kind of help push our conversations with sanctuaries forward. And then, you know, once that, so let's say we get from, this is purely hypothetical, but we say, hey, you know, we thought we were at 16, we're actually closer to 20 or 25. I'm not sure. Maybe nothing counts, but, you know, let's just say we get a little bit of a bump from that analysis. And then the really interesting question is, okay, well now how do we use these criteria to push some of those areas that maybe don't quite meet 30 by 30 definition yet, push them up, like, you know, through, like I said, that sanctuary work where we might be, you know, like focusing on those kelp no-take areas, right? Or these special eelgrass protection zones, or by implementing additional water quality measures on top of sanctuaries, things like that. So that's going to be that kind of next step is, okay, well, we got to work with whoever's managing these areas to see if there's some ways to get them to count if they don't. And that I think will be, you know, that'll be like the next 5 years of this work from, you know, next year to 2030 is building those partnerships, working with the managers, working with local communities, the people on the ground who actually have ties to those areas to see what else we can do. Again, based on those criteria. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. With being the, you know, just the common angler and talking with them and all that. And then, you know, when you start thinking about 20 by 30 and we're sitting here in 24, it's like, well, I mean, that's 6 years before anything could happen. So just right. Kind of curious on that one.
Right. Right. And I think, you know, we're going to want public engagement at all steps throughout this process. Right. So it's not like we're going to get those criteria finalized and then say, all right, well, thank you very much. You know, we can all go home now and see you in 2030. No, I mean, we're going to be, as we think through, how we're going to strengthen those protections in different areas, we'll want folks at the table. And we haven't quite figured that out yet, cause we don't know exactly what additional counts and what doesn't. But when we get there, then we'll start to design, you know, all right, how are we going to make sure folks have a seat at the table here? You know, I feel like we talked about trust a little earlier, and I worry that there's a perception that, you know, decisions are getting made without a transparent public process. This is the public process, right? And this year is going to be really big for the process. Like, we're not making any determinations without significant public input and bringing our angling friends along, the NGO communities along. Again, maybe, you know, people may not be thrilled with where we end up. People, I'm sure, will disagree on all sides about some of the determinations that we make, but that at least it's been transparent and that people feel like, all right, well, I have had a chance to have my voice heard and have my voice heard in a meaningful way. Right. So that's a really, you know, personally important to me. And I know to OPC leadership as well, is to have that transparency.
Right, right. That's so important. And so I, you know, it meaningful is a good word, because we really want, you know, the angling community really wants to be listened to on this one. We've lost so much in recent years in terms of angling access and through fisheries management as well, which we believe in, by the way. It's not that we don't believe in, but we've lost the salmon fishery this year.
Yeah.
We've had reductions in California halibut fish limits up in the bay. We've lost
ground fish.
A lot of ground fish access recently. So many anglers are feeling threatened and disenfranchised right now. So we have, I know the whole idea is, you know, we want to be listened to when we come to these meetings. We want to come there in a respectful manner and voice our concerns, but at the same time, we don't want to be dismissed out of hand in favor of listening to the you know, we have the idea that the NGOs, the environmental NGOs, are putting a lot of money behind campaigns, political campaigns, and so they get listened to more than we do. And that's, you know, whether that's true or not, that's our perception. They come to the table with, you know, with lots of money behind the politicians, and the politicians then, of course, have an effect on regulators, because they're going to put pressure on people, you know, who are creating these new rules. So we don't want money to become an overriding factor. And unfortunately, oftentimes it is.
Yeah, I hear that concern, and I understand, you know, that there's a lot of anglers out there with that perception. And I guess what I'd say to that is, you know, I have the privilege of working pretty closely with a lot of the leadership of these agencies, you know, and political leadership. That's kind of one of the cool things about working at OPC. And what I've seen is a real earnest desire and commitment to get this right, and to have 30 by 30 be a movement that ultimately leads to more biodiversity protection, but also more resilience to climate change. A lot of the you know, shocks and closures you were mentioning have roots in climate change, and also more access to the ocean for people, not taking away access. So, you know, for whatever my perception and my experience is worth, I've been really pleased, again, kind of coming from outside, like the policy political world and ending up in this job, to see such earnest commitment to, hey, let's listen, let's have these conversations, let's be transparent, and let's get it right. So it's been really
okay. Well, on that note, tell us a little bit about how anglers can get involved in the process and have their voices heard.
Yeah. So like I mentioned, we've got these four parallel tracks, right? So I'll kind of tick through each one by one. So First is the Decadal Management Review MLPA process. That is ongoing. So the commission is, you know, many of those petitions were submitted at the end of last year, but it's never too late to submit petitions because petitions are accepted on a rolling basis. And there's going to be much discussion this year at commission, full commission meetings and Marine Resources Committee meetings about the petitions that were received and potential changes to the network. So I'd encourage everyone to go on CDFW's website to maybe, you know, talk to folks at CCA Cal, because you guys do a great job, like I said, of organizing folks and getting them plugged in, to get involved in that process and to make your voice heard on adaptive management of MPAs. Second, I would note that, you know, National Marine Sanctuaries, those sanctuary advisory councils are public meetings. Right now, we're really focusing our collaboration with Farallones, because like I said, they're in the middle of updating their management plan. So listeners that happen to be in the, you know, Central Coast, San Francisco Bay area, now's the time to start getting involved in that process. Talk to your Sanctuary Advisory Council rep. You can come to Sanctuary Advisory Council meetings, and they're going to be having discussions about, hey, what are the threats to biodiversity in our sanctuary, and how should our new management plan address those threats? And we'll be there representing the state perspective and hopefully trying to shape that management plan into something that'll make the sanctuary or areas within the sanctuary count for 30 by 30. Then there's that bucket on all of the different areas that aren't MPAs or sanctuaries that we think have the potential to count. So that'll really be the next step. There is really that public process from June through fall to make public comment on the criteria, come to our workshops. We can have an open discussion about, okay, here's how the criteria would apply to different areas, like I said. And so that, you know, that'll be more details on that when we get a little bit closer to June. The fourth track about tribal, you know, right now, to be respectful of tribal rights, that's a conversation we're having behind closed doors with tribal governments. But we will share details on that as appropriate. You know, it's just not really a government. It's a government to government process right now, and not a you know, not a public process. But there will be more details shared as soon as we have more to share. And you can always check out our website, opc.ca.gov/30by30. We've got a fact sheet there with a lot of, you know, answers to frequently asked questions and recordings of webinars. We always post links to relevant stuff on our social media as well. And, you know, maybe you got my email. You can feel free to share in the show notes or something with your audience. I'm always happy to, just have conversations with folks, you know, answer folks' questions and address their concerns. So yeah, we really do want people to get involved.
So, and these meetings are virtual, so you don't have to travel to Sacramento or Petaluma or someplace far away to participate. Will you be able to participate via Zoom or some other video conferencing method?
Yeah, for all of these state agency meetings, and then also for our public workshops, hybrid is definitely the new way. So it enables more people to come, you know, they don't have to take time off work or, you know, burn a lot of fuel getting somewhere far away.
Excellent. Excellent.
You know, when in the spirit of transparency, I know we talked before we came on here a little bit late for Long Beach, for the Long Beach show next week, but it sounds like you might be making the trip down south to some of our consumer shows.
Yeah, that's the hope. So we're hoping to end up in Del Mar in mid-February for Bart Hall. And then, also, Chris and Jim just reminded me about PCS coming up. I think that's in March. So we're going to try to, we've got some, due to the state's budget woes, unfortunately, we do have some travel restrictions in place. So it makes it a little bit hard, but we are going to try to hit both of those to have some conversations. I was at Day of the Docks with Wayne last March, and it was great. I mean, you know, the anglers that were there asked me some pretty hard hitting questions. They didn't pull their punches, but we had some good conversations. And Jim, you know, I love it. And Jim, you, me, and Wayne, you know, we had a beer after and talked some of these things through. So I really do feel like showing up is really kind of the only way to build constructive relationships. You know,
yeah. That's great. We really appreciate you showing up too. That was great. I think everybody walked away. It's kind of funny. You know, we consider sometimes we think, oh, here's the enemy, but when you meet the enemy, he's not so bad.
Yeah. Hey, I'll take it.
Yeah. Mike, I think you hit the nail on the head there. You know, keeping the dialogue open, keeping the conversation going, you know, between the fishing community, the OPC, and basically amongst all these groups, because, you know, I think in essence, we all kind of agreed, you know, conservation is the key. 30 by 30 is great in concept and theory, but it's just trying to figure out a way that, you know, that works for everyone to accomplish that goal. And I think, you know, just simplistically speaking, you know, anglers are still a little wary and still a little concerned about, you know, the disruption to, you know, their recreational angling. And, you know, hopefully I think you've eased a couple minds at least.
That's the hope. And at least kick the door open for more conversation, right? So we're not just kind of a faceless government agency. We're people who care and who genuinely want to reach out and have conversations. So I would also say, you know, this is a great kind of high level introductory conversation, but as this year goes on with more public outreach, you know, if you guys will have me, I'd always be happy to join. Maybe I can come down and check out your new studios, which sound pretty sweet. But yeah, you know, come back on the pod and, you know, chat a little bit more as some of these details get worked out. Cause we just gotta keep the dialogue open, you know?
I think a great idea is to get out and go fishing and we can talk.
I was just about to ask.
I like that.
I was going to ask, Mike, do you fish at all?
I do. I'm pretty amateur. I've got some hook and line experience, you know, rock fishing up here in the Central Coast. And then I've tried my hand at spear fishing, free diving. That's really kind of my thing has been spearing, but I haven't gotten a chance to do it in a while, but I will certainly take up your offer and maybe go out and do some hook and line with you. If you know, I might embarrass myself a little, but
yeah, if you get down here for the PCS show, you know, it's close by. Like I'm in LA County, close to Orange County. We can go out and wet a line before the show and then go to work later.
That sounds fantastic.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Mike, it's been great having you, man. Any last words, any last thoughts on your end before we wrap it up here?
Yeah, I'd just say thank you. Thanks to both of you for hosting me today. It's been a really fun conversation. Really, really great to talk some of these things through, kind of give them the detail and attention they deserve, you know? And then also thanks to the broader CCA Cal community. You know, I think, guys are really, you know, you've pushed us hard. But I think for the good, right? Like, there's been a lot of good that's come out of this, initial dialogue that I would say is kind of turning into more of a collaboration. So yeah, my closing thoughts would just be thanks.
Excellent. Well, before we get going, how do we reach you? How, anything coming up that we need to be aware of and the website and social media and all that good stuff, lay it out for us.
Yeah. So, website is opc.ca.gov/30x30. You'll find a bunch of helpful links there. You'll find some, you know, kind of a helpful webpage that ticks through everything that I just mentioned about our four approaches and kind of where we are, blog posts on 30x30, recordings of webinars like that one Jim was mentioning that we did with the sanctuary. And then you can just search at OPC California on Twitter. I guess it's X now, on X. And Instagram and Facebook. We have social media presence across, I think we're even on LinkedIn now. So kind of across the board, good social media presence. And then my personal, or not personal, but my work email is michael.escro, ESGRO, at resources.ca.gov. So like I said, folks can feel free to drop me a personal line and we'll chat.
Excellent. Awesome, man. Well, appreciate you being here. Like what Jim mentioned, when you get down here sometime, because you're up in Monterey, right? I think.
Yeah, there. I'm in the Santa Cruz area.
Santa Cruz. So we'll have to have you down, and hopefully we'll see you at the shows coming up.
Yeah, that sounds fantastic. I'm looking forward to hopefully seeing you guys in about a month, and maybe getting out on the water and keeping the conversation going. Thanks, everybody.
Yeah. Thank you, Michael.
All right. Take care. Yeah.
Thank you, Mike. Thanks, Jim, for filling in and being on the podcast. I know you had plenty of questions for Mike there.
I did. I got more.
well, to his point, we'll have to keep that conversation going, and we'll have to have the fine folks at the OPC on as well. But anyway, thank you so much for joining us this week on the CCA California podcast, and we will see you guys next week. Take care.